Today's Teisho will be on case 44 in the Mwong Kan, in the Gate of No Barrier. Case 44 is entitled Basho's Staff. Basho Osho said to his disciples, "If you have a staff, I will give you a staff. If you have no staff, I will take it away from you." Mumon's comment, "It helps me wade across a river when the bridge is down. It accompanies me to the village on a moonless night. If you call it a staff, you will enter hell like an arrow." Mumon's verse, "The depths and shallows of the world are all in its grasp. It supports the heavens and sustains the earth. Everywhere it enhances the Dharma." Thank you very much for coming to practice meditation today on this beautiful, beautiful Saturday. I was setting up the Zendo last night, and two of my friends were here, still working late in this complex of offices. I don't actually work here. I work over in Murray Hall. But the writing program controls these rooms, and it's a lucky break for our community because we've been sitting here in this room for 20 years almost. And it's a perfect room. It's out of the way. We have a little kitchen. So this is a good place to do meditation. People in the daytime come in here and they see a tutoring center. Little do they know that this is really a Bodhi Mandala. A Bodhi Mandala is a place where awakening can take place. Many people have had awakening experiences in this room. This room has been the starting point for many people's journeys towards waking up. So things are not, as we say in Zen, things are not always what they seem, nor are they otherwise. So I was here setting up this room for the evening sit, and two of my friends were here, and they were talking. These are people I have known for maybe 20 years, as long as this has been a Zendo. And they are dear, dear friends of mine. And they are both political junkies, as I am, I have to confess. So George, one of my friends, is the most intense of the three political junkies in the room was George. And he said, "Kurt," as soon as he saw me, he said, "Kurt, did you see the debate? Trump. You know, Trump." They started talking about Donald Trump. And, nothing they said was a surprise to me, right? I mean, I suppose if somebody had said, "I've decided to vote for Trump," I would have been thunderstruck. But both of these people are sort of politically to the left as I am. And so that will never happen in this universe. I know that. And so everything they said was fairly predictable. If you think about it, much of what we say and much of what we think is fairly predictable. Fairly predictable. Now, this is why in Zen we don't put too much stock in words. In the morning, when we recite the verses on the heart mind, the Shin Shin Ming, it ends with words. Words. The way is beyond language. For in it there is no yesterday, no tomorrow, no today. See, words. you know, it's interesting that Zen has this attitude. When I was first began studying Zen, I was an English major. And I love poetry. I love novels and I love plays, but I love poetry. Even though I couldn't write a poem if you put a gun to my head, I love poetry. To hear my Zen teacher say words, the way is beyond language, words, almost with kind of like words, bah. And that was difficult for me. And I would go into Dokusan, I would go into the private interview with the teacher, and I would try to talk. I would try to explain my conceptualization to Genki Roshi. He would cut me right off. He'd say, those are words. It's like, how can I talk to you if I don't use words? I would be so frustrated. I would feel so blocked. The problem with language, the problem with words, is that generally speaking, they don't really convey any new information. You know? So when my friends were talking about the Republican debate, you know, I could almost finish their sentences for them. And I was chiming in too with sentences they could have finished or they could have said. Now, you know, this was a thoroughly enjoyable experience. It was wonderful. I enjoy so much speaking to like-minded people and trading ideas that we all already accept. You know, as I was wailing on the Republicans and venting my spleen and bouncing up and down with righteous anger, I was so happy, right? Because I was sharing these sentiments with my friends whom I've known for many years. It really wasn't so much about the Republican debate, which, by the way, I didn't see, and nevertheless I felt entitled to have an opinion about. It wasn't so much about the Republican debate, you know. It was just about being with two good friends. And it's a kind of a communal experience, right? It's kind of I looked over at my two friends, and I've known them, I've worked with them for so many years. And they're both characters, you know, they're both a kind of eccentric people. They're eccentric. One is a chain smoker. And I hope a miracle happens and he lives to be 90, but he is a chain smoker and it's not good for him. You know, and the other guy is not a chain smoker, but he's eccentric in his own way, you know. So these two guys I've known for a long time, their political positions are totally predictable. They're just like mine. And I just enjoyed the conversation, even though I came away with no new information. Right? So, you know, a lot of what we exchange with language is like that. You know, we depend so much on ideas. We think they're so real, but they're not really very real at all. And they're not really ours. They're not really ours. You know, ideas are a lot like money. You know, money, it doesn't belong to anybody. It just circulates. And as money circulates, you know, a $10 bill can go from your pocket to my pocket. It's still a $10 bill. When it's in my pocket, I say it's my $10 bill. And it feels like mine, but it's really not mine. It's in general circulation. You know, and ideas are just like that. When we have an idea, you know, it can feel so much like it's ours, but it's not. Very rarely do we have an original idea. In fact, there may not be any such thing as an original idea. You know, I have a friend of mine who wrote his dissertation when he was in graduate school on a novelist. And the whole time he was writing it, he was thinking, this is going to be a fantastic book. This is going to be wonderful. People are going to sit up and take notice. And he said he read a book review while he was finishing his dissertation, and the argument of the book he was reading was pretty much the argument he had just written. And he, you know, naturally he was crestfallen, because he thought he was saying something totally original, and somebody else had probably just said the same thing. You know, and this happens all the time. You know, it's true that an artist will paint a picture, you know, that seems stunningly original, but actually, you know, if you do some research, you realize this: the artist borrowed a little from this person, a little from that person, this way of doing shadows from this artist, this way of showing the light coming in from this artist. You know, pretty much we're all borrowing all the time, and that's not a bad thing. It's actually a good thing. We're all borrowing from each other all the time. But there's a limit to the power of language, because it is so conventional. It is so predictable, actually. You know, even ideas that seem fresh are really not your ideas. They're somebody else's. And often we think we're changing our lives by changing our ideas, but it's no more transformative than taking a $10 bill from a friend and putting it in your own pocket. We put too much faith in ideas. They have their place, they have their purpose, but they aren't really deeply transformative. That's the Zen view, at any rate. You know, when we start meditating and we sit down on the cushion, you know, our head is buzzing with ideas. It's buzzing with ideas. And they are swirling around in there, and it's so hard to focus on the breath. The first part of Zen practice is learning how to enter deep samadhi. Now, I can tell if somebody's in deep samadhi just by looking at them. You know, if somebody's on the cushion and they're moving a lot or they're fidgeting, you know, probably, chances are they're not in deep samadhi. Chances are. Usually when people are in deep samadhi, they're actually on the edge of a thoughtless state, of a wordless state. It takes a little while to get there. You know, when you sit down on the cushion as a beginner and your head is buzzing with thoughts, it's hard to get to the breath at all. You're trying to focus on your breath, but your thoughts, this river of thoughts, this torrent of thoughts, sort of sweeps you downstream. Then you have to sort of swim back up and get to the breath, and then you're swept downstream. And then you swim back up and you get to the breath and you're swept downstream. This goes on and on for a while. It can be a little frustrating. You know, one day, you get to the breath and you stay with the breath, and you'll notice that the thoughts are on the side of your attention. They're at the margin of your attention. They're not at the center. So the thoughts don't completely disappear, but they're going by sort of out of the corner of your mind. And the breath is focused, is right at the center of your attention. So you follow the first breath out, you follow the second breath out, you follow the third breath out, you follow the fourth, and so on. Meanwhile, over here on the margin of your attention, there's still that chatter, that constant chatter that goes on in another part of your mind. But, you know, when you're able to focus on the breath, something really remarkable happens. You know, you enter this sort of a wordless, timeless place, which is absolutely grounding and solid and even imperturbable, even imperturbable. When you achieve this state, which we in Zen just call, sort of as a shorthand term, we call that samadhi. When you can get to samadhi, when a Zen teacher says you need to get into deep samadhi, he means you need to get deeply into that wordless place, that almost motionless place. When you follow the breath out, it takes you to that stillness, and you become still. On the margins of your attention, there's still this flow, this chatter, but your mind is grounded in the breath, and it's still and blank to some degree. See, this is samadhi. Being able to get to this state is really important. Because when we're in our thoughts, when we're in our thoughts, we're not really in control. So, you know, when my friend was talking and he suddenly started thinking about Donald Trump's sexist remarks at the debate, he began to get very upset. So he had some thoughts, and the thoughts triggered emotional responses. And those emotional responses overwhelmed him, So this is how thoughts often affect us. So, you know, if you're worried about something, if something is, let's say your car wasn't working properly and you had to take it to the car repair place, you know, maybe you don't have much money in the bank, so you're worried about fixing your car. And you take it to the car repair guy and you say, it's making this strange noise. And he looks very concerned. Like, could be fatal. And you go home and you think, you can hear him saying, that sounds like I'll have to replace the carburetor. Something like that. And you know that's going to be a lot of money. So you keep replaying the face of your mechanic saying to you, that could be the carburetor. And every time that happens, you feel like a little thrill of terror because you know you are going to have a hard time paying for that with the money you have left in the bank, see? So the thought triggers an emotional reaction. Now, and if you're a certain kind of person, you do this to yourself all day long, right? All day long, these are loops we get into in our head where a thought or an idea or a mental image triggers an emotional response over, and it's often it's the same response. So, you know, you want to watch TV in the evening because you're thinking about the mechanic, and you watch the show, but you get up to get a drink of water. And when you turn on the tap, there's the mechanic in your head, and he's saying it could be the carburetor, and there's the emotional reaction. And then you go to bed, and there's the mechanic, and you wake up, and there's the mechanic. So, we become prisoners of our thoughts, of our image, these mental images, these ideas. Sometimes they're abstract concepts, sometimes they're memories. But we become prisoners and they keep triggering these emotional responses, and many people get caught up in these loops and they just can't get out, even though they know rationally it's totally unproductive to be there. It's like, how many times do you have to torture yourself thinking about your car bill? See, you can torture yourself once. You can think, uh-oh, that could be trouble. And then you could wouldn't it be nice if you could just put it down? Said, I've already worried about that. I won't think about it again. But it's very hard to have that kind of mental control. Usually, if something causes us with distress, we begin to obsess over it and get caught in these loops. So being able to enter samadhi is an amazingly wonderful gift. And if you train your mind to enter deep samadhi, you can find an imperturbable place. And you can go there when events might be causing you distress. See, this is invaluable in dealing with all kinds of problems. You know, we worry because actually we feel out of control. And worrying is a way of reassuring ourselves that we're in control even when we're not. But it's not a good strategy, right? We feel out of control. We can't really control if our old car needs a repair job or not. And rather than just admit to ourselves we have no control, which takes a very deep mind, you have to do a lot of sitting to be comfortable with that idea. Rather than do that, we obsessively worry as a way of prolonging this illusion of control. If I can't, maybe if I think enough about the car repair, the price will go down or the carburetor will heal, right? This is like totally magical thinking, but we do it all the time. constantly obsess, obsess, obsess. It's almost like saying, it's like thinking the worst possible thing. If I just think the worst possible thing, that won't happen. It'll be something less. He'll come in and say, oh, it was just a loose nut. We tightened it. That's 50 cents. So basically, we have these mental habits that are cause us a lot of distress and are not really very beneficial. And being able to enter deep samadhi is quite important. And one aspect of deep samadhi is not hanging on to your mental projections, not hanging on to your thoughts. So when you sit down on the cushion, you need to begin to focus on the breath and create a space between yourself and your thoughts. And this is very difficult, especially for intellectuals. People who do a lot of thinking have a very hard time parting with their wonderful ideas, which are very much part of their identity structure. You know, but you could always come back to your book later on. When you're on the cushion, be free. Be free. So, you know, you can't think about so-and-so 24 hours a day. You can think about so-and-so in an hour. But right now, just be present with your breath, and your thoughts begin to recede, and you begin to enter this open space, this still, grounded, open space, this thoughtless place. And usually when people can enter that place, even if it's just for intermittently, just every sit you might be able to get to that place just a little bit now and then, but the effect is dramatic. You'll be able to sit very deeply. That kind of person will be sitting like a rock on his or her cushion. So it doesn't take much samadhi to begin to calm down. But when we get into samadhi, we're in a way liberating ourselves from words and ideas and from concepts, see? And this is a hugely, hugely helpful. You know, I have had the pleasure of associating with people who are deeply awake. You know, I've run into a number of people from the Zen world who were really amazing human beings, you know, and they had practiced Zazen for many, many years and had, you know, exquisite, you could say exquisite mental control. You know. My teacher Genki Roshi was very much like that, you know. He was able to be so focused on the moment, so present in this thoughtless state, that things that would have bothered other people really didn't bother him. You know, if you can get into this thoughtless state, it transforms everybody, everything, absolutely everything. You know, in some Buddhist literature, in the Japanese tradition called Pure Land, there's this idea of like a Buddhist paradise, Buddha paradise, the Pure Land. People in Japan, some people think there is a pure land somewhere else, where Amida is in charge, we could say. But actually, you know, the pure land is right here if we have the correct mind, if we're in the correct mind. So, you know, when you're in this thoughtless state and you experience the world around you, it is Buddha paradise itself. Honestly, you know, in a couple of weeks we're going to do a sesshin. And at the end of sesshin, you know, or even around day two or day three of sesshin, you know, people sit down to eat. And they eat some rice. And when they eat the rice, it's so delicious. It's unbelievable. It's just rice, but it's so delicious. Or when we have some stir-fried vegetables or some lentils, it's just like, oh! This is so delicious. At the end of sesshin, people will say, this food, what is this food? The food here is so good. Right? It's eating the food with a mind of stillness, a mind of openness, this wordless samadhi mind. Everything becomes the pure land, the pure land. Getting to this place requires a kind of willingness to let go of your ideas and your concepts, As I said, this is very difficult for intellectuals because intellectuals tend to believe that if they can just get to the right idea, everything will be better. See? Now, you know, ideas do have a value. They do make a difference. So I'm not saying you should never read another book or never write another paragraph. I'm not saying that. But we tend to overestimate how effective words are in transforming our lives. You know, when I was in college, I was an existentialist. I read Sartre, and I loved Sartre. And I thought Sartre was the last word on existence. And then I read somebody else. Right? And I thought, well, Sartre, he's okay, but this is different. Then I read somebody else, read Heidegger. They're okay, but this is different. You know? Every time you read a new author, it's like it does take you to a new place. And it is exciting, and it can be very useful. But you know, how deeply does it really transform us? You know, you can be an existentialist, you can follow Sartre, you can follow Heidegger, you can be a Democrat. You could be a Republican. I hope you aren't, but if you are, it could happen, right? It could happen to anybody. Some of the people in my family, I love them, but you could change your parties, you could change your philosophy, but how you experience the moment probably won't be changed very much. You know. So if you have a habit of anxiety, let's say, changing your philosophy isn't going to take that away, if only that were true, right? You know, if you get a cancer diagnosis, you know, you could say, that does it. I'm no more Heidegger for me. I'm going to read so-and-so. That's not going to help, see. You know, the power of language to transform our lives is very limited. So in Zen we say words. The way is beyond language, for in it there is no yesterday, no tomorrow, no today. There's another aspect of language which people don't really think about very much. You know, words... let me go back to the koan. This is a Zen master who's giving a Dharma talk. And he basically is about... He's giving this talk and he's talking and he's talking and he's talking just like I am. And he stops. And he thinks to himself, you know, I'm sitting here yakking away about Buddhism. But how many people here would be able to, be able to understand these ideas on their own without my help? And if they can't do that, if they don't really understand what Buddhism is all about on their own, what good is it for me to talk about it? So he's giving this regular talk, and then he sort of stops. And he you know, when Zen teachers come into the teaching hall, the Dharma hall, to deliver a teisho, in ancient times they would carry a big staff, like a shepherd's staff, which was a symbol of their, you could say, their authority or something. So, you know, next to him he would have had a staff, so... He stops speaking for a minute. Everybody's wondering what's going on. And suddenly he picks up his staff and he holds it up. He holds it aloft and he says, if you have a staff, I will give you one. And if you have no staff, I will take it away. So he's waiting for somebody to respond. He's waiting for, this is kind of like a provocation. He's asking them a Zen question. See, he holds the staff up and he says, if you have a staff, I'll give you one. And if you have no staff, I'll take it away. And then he waits. And he's waiting for somebody, all these monks and nuns, to respond, to do something. Nothing happens. So he's, you know, he has a little smile on his face. He gets up and he walks out. And that's the end of the lecture period. See? So, you know, this is a koan. And in our tradition, people meditate on koans. So right now, if you're starting to practice Zen, you're probably working on watching the breath until you can enter samadhi, deep samadhi. You should be able to sit very motionless for a fairly long period of time and occasionally be able to enter a thoughtless state. Now, once you can do that, the teacher will give you a koan, a subject for meditation. And if we practice together long enough, I hope we'll have the opportunity to do this koan. So the basho in the story holds up the staff and he says, if you have a staff, I will give you one. If you have no staff, I will take it away. Now, you know, if you are working on this koan, you're supposed to sit down on the cushion, enter samadhi, and internalize the story, just like a mantra. So you could say, give, take, give, take, give, take, that way. But you know, this story is very, like so many koans, is really very frustrating, right? If you have a staff, the master will give you a staff, but you don't need a staff, so, you know, if you have one. So his giving you a staff would be totally a futile gesture, see? What's the point of that? I don't need a staff. On the other hand, if you have no staff, how can he take it away, see? So, you know, the koan gives us two choices. Two choices. If you have a staff, you don't have a staff. If you have a staff, I'll give you one. If you don't have a staff, I'll take it away. You know, neither of these choices, you know, it's got to be A or it's got to be B. It has to be this one or it has to be this one. But neither one makes any sense. Neither one is an acceptable answer, you know. So it's possible to sit down and just go over this koan obsessively in a little loop in your head, just like everything else in life, right? You know, the mind that thinks in language wants to say it's either A or it's B. It's either this or it's the opposite, that. It's this or it's that. And you can go, you can sit with this koan for a long time, and you can go into the Dokusan room and say, here's a staff. And the teacher will say, no, that's not the right answer. And you can go you could go into the Dokusan room and you could grab the teacher's bell, like taking the staff away, and the teacher will tell you, that's not the right answer. See? So this is what's so wonderful about Zen, in my opinion. We are not very good at doing, because we rely on words and ideas, we're not very good at changing our lives or getting out of our traps or escaping from our dead ends. You know, escaping from our dead ends. Because, you know, when we think, all we do is return to what we already know. See, when you think, you only repeat what you already know. All thinking can tell you, in a way, is what you already know. See? So, you know, let's say you're having a crisis. You know, maybe you're going to break up with your boyfriend or your girlfriend. And part of you is really saying break up. But on the other hand, another part of you is saying, well, you can't do this to this person because, he or she has a lot of affection for you. So you say, okay, I'll go get some advice. But, you know, the advice you seek, in a way, is the advice you want, right? So you're definitely not going to go to somebody you know will say, don't break up. You won't do it. You'll find somebody who will sort of say, well, maybe it's okay to break up. Or you'll keep asking to find that person. See, our thinking is not very good way to break out of our traps. It's like saying, tell me something you've never thought of before. You can't do it, right? So, thinking isn't a good way of changing our life. It's very hard to change our life by trying to think through our problems. Because when we think, all we can rely on is what we already know. See? So this koan is really about this problem. If you have a staff, I'll give you one. If you have no staff, I'll take it away. So, the only way to change your life, actually, actually, it is to do something that doesn't make sense. Yes, that's true. If you're stuck, the only way to change your life is to do something that doesn't make sense. So, in the case of this koan, what would have been a wonderful answer, the teacher stops his teisho, holds up the staff and says, if you have a staff, I'll give you one. If you have no staff, I'll take it away. He's waiting for the monks to respond. What would have been a good response? I'll tell you. A good response, somebody might have gotten up and started tap dancing. That would have been a wonderful answer. Somebody could have gotten up and turned cartwheels. Wonderful answer. See, somebody could have gotten up and sung the Japanese equivalent of Swanee River. Right? The master would have been ecstatically happy. See, no matter what anybody would have done, it would have been a good answer. If it were coming from that place where it doesn't make any sense. We value sense too much, right? Discovering something new in life is not like aiming your arrow at a target and hitting the bullseye. That's just repeating what you already know. See, that's all the mind can do if it relies on words and ideas. Another way to do it is instead of aiming for the target and shooting for the bullseye, you just shoot your arrow in the air and you go wander around until you find your arrow and you see where it landed. And then you paint the bullseye around the arrow. See? That's Zen. That's Zen. You could say, like a leap of faith, and then you wind up somewhere and you say, where am I? See? This is changing your life. This is changing your life. If you can only find something new by no longer making sense, see. So, in Zen, we have this concept of Zen spontaneity. Zen spontaneity. You're sitting on the cushion, and you're working with your koan, and you're totally blocked because you're trying to think it through. And you enter this thoughtless state, and sometimes you're ready to take a risk. You're ready to take a leap, Sometimes you kind of know in your heart what leap you should take. Many years ago, my teacher, Genki Roshi, it was raining outside, and Genki Roshi gave me a koan, which is not in the koan books. He said, I want you to, something like, I want you to... I want you to bring me the voice of the raindrops, something like that. You think, the voice of the raindrops, what the hell? And how can you bring the voice of the raindrops to the teacher? It was raining, and I sat all day with the sound of rain. And I came in to see the teacher, and I said the truth. I said, Genki, when I listen to the sound of rain, I disappear and I become the sound of rain. And Genki Roshi said, that's a pretty good answer, but it's not the best answer. And I said, well, what would be a better answer? And he jumped up and he ran around the room going, like that. That was a good answer. That was a better answer than my answer. I thought of doing that myself, but I thought, what a fool I would be to do that, right? To just jump up and try to make a sound like rain, right? And he ran all around the room. He just did this little circle around the room where he was flapping his robes. I wanted to do that so badly, but I was held back by my self-consciousness, my self-doubts, And when he did it, I just thought, God damn it, that's the right answer. That's the right answer. He was not afraid to make no sense. He was not afraid to take a leap. We can't get out of our traps. We can't think our way out of our traps. You get out of your trap by doing something that doesn't make sense. And there's a part of you that says, oh, please don't make me do that. You know, don't take that risk. But you know, when you take it, it usually feels so wonderful. So, you know, in Zen, we develop what we call Zen spontaneity. We always second-guess ourselves. We second-guess ourselves. You know, something inside of us says, do this. Oh, no. Now, I'd be a fool. I'd look like a fool. What would people say? You know, in Zen, we sit on the cushion until we can enter this deep samadhi state, this wordless, thoughtless state. And when you spend a lot of time in that state, you begin to experience a kind of radical trust in yourself. We say in Zen, your true self, like radical trust. You know, sometimes there's a voice that's telling us something, but we don't want to hear it because it's not the voice of respectability or reasonability. You know, so we tamp it down. But you know, when you practice getting to that thoughtless, wordless place, you begin to have a different relationship to yourself and to the world. It's a more open, honest relationship with yourself and the world. And you know, you suddenly can act out of a trusting heart. You know, you act out of a trusting heart. And this is what we call Zen spontaneity. You know, if only I wanted to do it. You know, I came in and the teacher said, Genki Roshi said, okay, give me the voice of the raindrops. And I was inhibited by my self-doubt, by self-consciousness, too much thinking. So I said, Genki, I become the raindrops. He said, that's okay. Let me show you a better answer. And, you know, he just made a fool of himself, right? And it was so liberating to see that. You know. And it must have felt so good to do that, to have that much trust in yourself. Basho Osho said to his disciples, if you have a staff, I will give you one. If you have no staff, I will take it away from you. See? You know, this is real, this is the road to real freedom. Real freedom. You know, so often what we want in life, what we want or what we think we want, is just what other people want for us. You know, all our lives we're living out the fantasies of our parents or of somebody somewhere else, you know. And, you know, we don't always even think we know what we really want or what would make us happy. You know, it's so interesting to meet people, actually, who you can say to them, what would really make you happy? And they don't know. I don't know. You know, that's actually quite common. So people so often are doing what others expect them to do. So if you have a staff, I will give you a staff. If you have no staff, I will take it away. This is real freedom. When you cultivate that trusting mind, you know, the world becomes Buddha paradise. It's like being in contact with a kind of energy that we are constant, you know, there is in the human being this amazing energy. And as we're growing up, we learn to close it off. And so, you know, by the time you're 40 years old, it's pretty thoroughly closed off if you're not careful. You know, this incredible life energy that we gradually learn how to shut down on, because we get embarrassed, we do, you know, people criticize us, we're constantly second guessing ourselves, we're constantly getting caught up in these loops. And this habit of self-distrust drains away all of our energy But if we cultivate this empty samadhi mind, this trusting mind, you know, you begin to have you begin to feel that energy welling up in yourself. It's like this unlimited joy in being alive. Mumon's comment, that energy, he says, it helps me wade across a river when the bridge is down. So any obstacle, like you can overcome any obstacle if you can get in touch with that. It accompanies me to the village on a moonless night. See, if you call it a staff, you will enter hell like an arrow. In other words, you know, when you second guess yourself, you cut yourself off from that energy. You know, if you cultivate Zen spontaneity, see, you know, every time you encounter an obstacle, it's either this or that. It's never just this or that. See, there's always something you're not seeing. So how do you see what you're not seeing? You do something that doesn't make sense. You shoot the arrow in the air and you go paint the target around it. This is Zen practice. If you call it a staff, if you rely on what others think, if you rely on words and ideas, you will not live in Buddha paradise. You will go straight to hell. Mumon's verse. The depths and shallows of the world are all in its grasp, this freedom, this energy. It supports the heavens and it sustains the earth. Everywhere it enhances the Dharma.